Здравствуйте, вы смотрите новости на Первом канале, в студии Анатолий Лазарев.
Здравствуйте, это новости на РЕН-ТВ, мои коллеги и я, Дмитрий Ясминов, расскажем о главных темах.
2 часа дня в Москве. День добрый, вы смотрите канал «Россия-24».
Добрый вечер, вас приветствует информационная служба телекомпании НТВ. Это программа «Сегодня» в студии Ольги Павловой.
Television. If you get your news from it in Russia, as most there do, chances are you're being spoon-fed a steady diet of slickly produced state-sponsored spin. This is just as true for nominally private stations like NTV as it is for official state outlets like Channel One. The Kremlin's TV monopoly has long been a bone of contention for the Russian opposition, and as a wave of anti-government protests swept the country following the disputed December 4th parliamentary elections, outgoing President Dmitry Medvedev promised to change all that. And this week, he appeared to deliver on that promise by announcing the formation of Russia's first public television channel, something the Kremlin is billing as similar to the BBC in Great Britain or PBS in the United States.
The decree provides for a number of measures that will make this television channel really public, rather than state or any other kind. And accordingly, measures that will guard this public institution from excessive state influence.
But as always is the case in Russia, the devil is in the details. And the details here suggest that Russia's new public television station will be far from independent and far from free of state influence. Its board, the Public Television Council, will be appointed by the public chamber, a state body accountable to the Kremlin. Moreover, the final composition of the council must be confirmed by the president, and the station's director will be appointed directly by the president himself. Not exactly a recipe for an independent television station. Media, politics, and Russia's changing information landscape. Hello and welcome to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
State-sponsored information, or propaganda, according to its detractors, has come a long way in Russia over the past few decades. Gone are the old, stale news anchors in their boxy gray suits, the monotone cadence, the poor production value that characterized Soviet-era news broadcasts. The Kremlin has since become frighteningly good at conjuring up its own version of reality and selling it to the public. State television anchors now are young and hip. The sets are stylish, and the production values are first rate. But they also have competition. With the state monopolizing television, independent media is flourishing online, a trend best exemplified by the impressive success of the independent internet television station Dozh TV. Internet penetration in Russia is rising rapidly, and a new generation is increasingly turning its back on state channels, no matter how high their quality. This is the atmosphere that Russia's new public television station is being born into. What effect, if any, will it have on the information landscape, Kirill? Will it be simply another state media outlet, or will it be something else entirely?
You're absolutely right. Devil is in the details, and let's investigate
the details. Yeah, yes, that's what I hope to do.
Yeah. First of all, it's not a first public television in Russia.
I would say the first real,
yes.
If you call ORT in the 90s
ORT,
public.
Yes, yeah. it was public in Russian terms. Yeah. And that is the question. What are the Russian terms?
Well, is,
yes.
Yeah, okay.
First of all of us know that it was ORT, so-called. So it's a public
Russian television.
Television. And a lot of events and bloody events happened around this.
Yes.
Including the murder of Vlad Listyev and Berezovsky. Scandals and so on. And this public television, public Russian television, ORT, had been kind of a most powerful thing behind the rising of Vladimir Putin to power.
Yes.
Because, as you remember, sure, you remember that Boris Berezovsky was one of those who invented Vladimir Putin as a political
together
figure.
Together with the Yeltsin family.
The Yeltsin family and so on. So, first experience of Russian public television was not very happy. It was not a bad TV channel, by the way. It was rather interesting. Of course, it was, in my opinion, it was worse than it was NTV in 1990s.
Yeah, yeah. It also turned into a tool for Berezovsky, for Boris Berezovsky, to pursue his political agenda.
Yes, and the same time, do you remember all these battles with Lushkov?
The battles with Gusinski.
Yeah.
But it didn't, I know in name it was a public television station, but in reality it was Berezovsky TV, basically, and Svanidze TV.
Sure. this is the first point. Second point, we are speaking about kind of brand new, as Dmitry Medvedev told, brand new public television in Russia. Let's discuss what is the TV channels in Russia for and about.
Mm-hmm.
That's very interesting. First of all, it's one of the very important tools to make money, just to make money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all this industry around TV channels in Russia, huge. It's absolutely huge. One of the most extensive financial fields in Russia, areas in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, of course, this is kind of political tool. But what kind of tool is this? Reminded our audience about Soviet style newscasts and so on. I'm not sure that from the professional point of view, this and ideological point of view, Soviet newscast and Soviet information services on TV channels was not much bad. I can explain this.
Okay, because I'm saying nobody believed it.
Yes, but if we try to consider what were they for,
mm-hmm.
they played their role very, very, very good and effective.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, the anchorman and anchorwomen, they were not so old, as you told. They were around 30, 40. Mm-hmm. So it's okay in our understanding, in our meaning of so modern television and so on. Of course, from the fashion point of view, it was slightly, remote from perfection.
The optics weren't great, what we would say today.
Yes, but if you watch the old, Western German TV, you'll see that.
Yeah.
Looks like the same thing, but a little bit better, but the same thing. But I'm not a specialist in design and fashion,
right.
TV design and so on. Let's speak about the content. Soviet-style television, or Soviet television, was about propaganda and ideology.
Mm-hmm.
The very foundation of this television, of all Soviet media, was the idea of communism and the point of view, communist, so-called communist, and at the same time, imperialistic point of view, because Soviet Union at the same time was a state of communist ideology, and at the same time it was an empire.
An empire, yeah.
And a great power. This mix had been the foundation, as I told you, had been the foundation of all this Soviet television. And they played this role very, very effective. Of course, there were a lot of dissidents and so on, but it was the minority of TV audience.
But I'm not even excluding the dissidents. How many ordinary people really believed what they were seeing?
It's an interesting question. It's a question for opinion polls and sociologists and so on, specialists in Soviet history. But as I understand, of course, a lot of people, they don't believe in some special things about this propaganda. For instance, if you live in Gorky, mm-hmm. or in Novosibirsk or in Sverdlovsk. And someone on the TV screen is speaking about the great successes of, say,
Soviet agriculture.
Agriculture, mm-hmm. and his fridge is absolutely
empty. Well, this
yes.
is what I mean.
Yes. This is true. But when they speak about Soviet foreign policy, about whatever, about war in Vietnam or about Iranian revolution, there is no any point not to believe them because mm-hmm. they don't know another point
of view. They don't have any other
yes.
access information.
Moreover, they were intoxicated by this ideology. Unconsciously, they stood of the point of view of class war, class struggle, of the preeminence of Soviet Empire, Soviet Union, or whatever, mm-hmm. and so on. If we're speaking now about the today information and the today ideology, which is behind of Soviet-style Russian, modern Russian TV channels, there is, as we told a lot of times, there is no any ideology behind this.
No. What the big difference to me is, and you touched on it here, is that the Soviet television didn't have to compete with outside information resources to get the propaganda through.
If you save Radio Svoboda, save Radio BBC, Svoboda, Russian okay. service, and no, Deutsche Welle.
But yeah.
And Voice of America.
And Voice of America. But today, if you look at Channel 1 and TV or any of these other, they have to compete in a global information space and still get the message that the Kremlin wants out at the time. Now, you're right. There isn't an ideology, but there are the Kremlin's needs of the moment. And there are the line that they do want to sell to the public at any given moment. And they have to get that out in an information jungle where there's so many competing sources of information out there. And they got to do it in a slick, hip way, right? Because otherwise, the Russians have access to the globalized information culture. And so to attract them, you gotta be good.
Yes, and this is my third point. Focusing on the TV channels, only on the TV channels, focusing on the idea of the total or half-total control over TV channels in Russia, Kremlin and all the aides of Kremlin and so on, and supporters of it, they define their area of influence in modern Russia. They close another possibilities for them to be influential in the circles or social stratas of population which doesn't receive or get the news from their TV channels, from the TV screen.
You mean the creative class that's
yes,
getting it from the
yes,
internet?
Yes, a lot of them. And that is it's very interesting because this idea of a new TV channel, not a new, I don't know, half-official internet website and so on. It's all about television.
Yes.
This is a very symbolic thing for so-called Putin 2.0. A lot of people, experts, politologists and so on, they discussed what it would be when Putin will return to mm-hmm. presidential power. So now we see it's not about the whole country. It's not about modernization. It's not about creative class. It's just about those who watch TV.
Mm-hmm.
And
which is the majority.
This is the majority.
Now.
But, yes, now. But it's a... sorry, it's contradiction, but it's a weak majority.
Mm-hmm.
It's a weak in economic sense, in social sense, in political sense.
In a demographic sense.
Whatever. So this is a weak majority. And Putin now, because Medvedev is part of this Putin game, of mm-hmm. course, sure.
Of course he is.
Because it's a future president will do all these things with the appointed president and so on. Future, not Medvedev, but
right.
Putin.
Yeah.
So this is a sign of the idea, Kremlin idea, to totally depend on this so-called weak majority of Russian population.
Now, do they, because Are they just going to turn this into another state channel, do you think? Or do they have to at least give the facade of creating at least Potemkin public television, so to speak?
I think the second option... Sorry. I think a second option will prevail. Because, of course, they have to differ somehow in commercial sense, mm-hmm. in whatever, in strategic sense, various TV channels. So this new public television will be slightly liberal, I am sure. Mm-hmm. But it will be the same thing. Mm-hmm. It will be the same, absolutely the same thing, because the audience of this channel, I think they try to depend on one part of Russian intelligence.
So it'll be like Izvestia to the to Channel One's Pravda, if you want to use the analogy of the Soviet newspapers.
I am not sure that the future of this new public Russian television will be bright. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. I think it will then stick to the core of state propaganda, and that's all. The same thing was with Fifth Channel in St. Petersburg.
Yeah, I remember that. I covered that whole thing in the 90s from Petersburg.
But I'd like to draw your attention to another very interesting thing. They're not thinking about this part of Russian society who is watching not TV screen, but computer screen. Till this day, state or Kremlin effort in this part of media landscape we can just watch or see or find. We see one official and very aggressive website. It's an information website. It's Vzgliad.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not...
Regnum-Ru.
Yes. Regnum. There are Regnum-Ru, two of them, Regnum-Ru was kind of an imperial project.
Yeah.
Vzgliad, it was and still is a kind of project from right, conservative, nationalistic, moderate nationalistic mm-hmm. point mm-hmm. of view. But both of them, they failed.
Mm-hmm.
And in both occasions, they tried to... use the money of some pro-Kremlin oligarchs and so on. But these oligarchs, as I know, it's internal information, they are not and were not very happy mm-hmm. to
put their money into this.
And that is why it's partly it's a failure.
Well, you have to wonder, and it was inevitable that I was going to get to Doge TV because it's one of, I don't know what you think, it was one of my, I think it's one of the best information resources in Russia right now. The editor-in-chief of Doge TV, Mikhail Zigar, had a very interesting article in Vedomosti this week where he was talking about how the Kremlin likes to clone everything. Basically, to fight back against the Orange Revolution, they created their own youth movement, Nashi. Right? When you have an anti Kremlin protest in Bolotnaya Ploshchad, they create a pro Kremlin protest somewhere else. So they keep cloning everything the creative class does. Never mind the opposition; it's the creative class.
Kremlin. Kremlin official postmodernism. To make kind of simulacrum.
You have to wonder if they're doing it on purpose. I mean, they must be doing it. I mean, that they're like, okay, we're just going to copy everything they do to kind of, I don't know, confuse the public, create the illusion of pluralism. I don't know. Now, Doge TV has become very, very successful beyond what anybody could imagine, and it's remained free of interference and pressure. Not free from pressure, of course, but it's remained very independent.
So far.
I watch it every day, and I'm very impressed with what I see. Do you expect the Kremlin to clone Doge TV and create their own kind of pro-Kremlin Doge clone on the internet? Or do you expect them to try to shut it down? Or do you expect them to let it continue as it is and be like the Echo Moskvy of those time where there's this one thing that they let kind of be a safety valve for dissent?
I think no. First of all, because it's my opinion, Doge TV is a kind of, internet TV clone of Echo Moskvy. It's lively. Echo Moscow in the earlier...
In the earlier period.
Earlier period, not now.
My
not
personal
now.
Opinion, I much more enjoy Dosht than
Dosht I Dosht is
I
better
Echo
now.
But
Dosht is better now. But remember, Echo Moscow attended the 90s or in the beginning of the 2000s. Yeah. So you'll see it's the same paradigm. It's very lively. A lot of talk shows, a lot of live streams and so on. It's focused on intelligentsia and creative class, and it tries to be cool. It tries to be cool.
I think it succeeds.
Yes. The only thing that Kremlin and its people couldn't cope, it's this coolness.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Coolness is not the thing that you can buy or sell.
And there's also other things they won't be able to imitate. First of all, I doubt they'll be able to get the likes of Ksenia Sobchak, who draws big audience numbers to Dosht TV. But they also, one of the things that really impresses me that they do, they stream their editorial meetings online.
Yeah.
And every day, in the middle of the day, I can, like, watch them discuss, and as a journalist, this is fascinating. As a Russia watcher, it's fascinating. Them discussing, how should we cover this story? What angle should we take? Who's going to do that? And, you know, we have meetings every day here, and it would be amazing. I'm not sure I want the outside world watching our meetings.
I'll never admit any translation from this.
They do this. They do this, and it's there for the whole world, or at least the whole world, that anybody in the world that speaks Russian, to watch. And you'll... I mean,
one more talk show, yeah.
It's one more talk show, yeah. But it is entertaining. They're aware they're on TV.
Yes, because it's the very idea of openness.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know? And the very idea of transparency is the same as freedom.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that that is true, because I am not a great admirer of this idea of the transparency of everything. Yes, but in these conditions, it could be kind of substitute for freedom or liberty in Russia. That's why it's so popular. So when you are opening all the doors,
mm-hmm.
you're going to speak everything, and everyone will be happy because you opened the door.
Right.
But then... The next day or next year, people will have to think about what he's speaking about all this time,
right,
with the open doors. I'm not criticizing Dosht TV, but you have to understand that it's a very effective measure,
yeah,
to draw attention and popularity and so on to this media, but it cannot last forever.
Well, they do all sorts of stuff. They'll have them eating. They'll be preparing lunch, yeah, and they'll put this on, yes, online as well. And then the next minute, you'll have an interview with a high Kremlin official and then an opposition,
yeah,
figure.
Yes. Mixing everything with everything.
Yeah,
you know, it's kind of democratic, as they think, democratic idea that everything is on the same level.
Yeah.
But it's not true.
It's not true. It's not true, but it's very effective as a media tactic.
Yeah.
It's very effective as a media tactic. One thing I wanted to get to before we move on to our next segment is, like, you mentioned at the outset, and I did want to talk about this, what happened the last time Russia tried to create a public television station. And there's a reason I said first public television station, because I didn't really consider that a public television station. I considered it Berezovsky TV. But this one too. Yeah.
But, forthcoming
this one as well.
Also, yeah.
But if you go back to the last attempt... And the Listiev murder, which was horrible, Berezovsky's takeover of the station, and then ORT being used primarily as a political tool for whatever Berezovsky's political needs of the moment. And the last one of these was the invention
create,
of Vladimir,
yeah,
Putin. Do you think that the current elite, and Vladimir Putin in particular, have overlearned the lessons of the 90s? And I'll explain what I mean. In the 90s, the television was all controlled by different oligarchs, was used by different oligarchs for different purposes, and it was a very volatile situation. There was pluralism. It was fascinating as a TV viewer to watch ORT and then watch NTV and then watch RTR and kind of get all these different perspectives.
Schizophrenia, yeah.
It was schizophrenia, but you could also figure out, okay, this is what Berezovsky's up to and this is what Lushkov's up to. You could really kind of get a feel for where who was what. But do you think that they are afraid of repeating that history? And then if you repeat this history again, you'll just have oligarchs run wild controlling all of the information space. Have they overlearned the lessons of the 90s in some ways?
One of the most important things about this is that there are no any independent oligarchs in Russia who will pay for all these games. Who will pay, as it was Berezovsky and Guzinski, mm-hmm. who were absolutely independent from Yeltsin and from Lushkov and so on. They played the political games, but they were not on the hook.
Yeah. Now, you're speaking objectively, yes. and yeah. I'm speaking more subjectively from Putin's point of view. He seems to be obsessed with not letting this to get not letting the oligarchs get out of his control. And if they start to have control yes. of television stations, well, then they could become independent. Rather rapidly.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure about oligarchs, not about TV channels, because mm. journalists...
Not the TV channels being independent. Yes, I mean the oligarchs using the TV
yes,
channels
yes.
for their own agenda. Yeah,
I'm not sure, because all of these oligarchs, from Usmanov to Abramovich or Prokhorov and so on, are they're all hugely influenced by Kremlin politics mm. and KGB-style... Mm. Pressure, you know, and they're very vulnerable, very mm. vulnerable in all the absolutely in all the aspects of their behavior and economic political strategy and so on. So anyway, sure, Mikhail Prokhorov distanced a little bit from Kremlin, and he can I cannot exclude the idea that he will be the main sponsor of this public new public TV. Mikhail Prokhorov, I think.
Well, there are rumors that he wants to buy Deutsche TV. Now, more
yes,
than rumors,
I know. Yes, he wants to buy everything. You know, he tried to buy Novaya Gazeta. You know,
yeah.
you
yeah,
remember
yeah.
this
yeah.
and Deutsche TV and Echo Moskvy and whatever. He just maybe he's just crazy about shopping.
I think it's probably more to that. In a few moments, we're going to shift gears and we're going to talk about an interesting election campaign that's shaping up in the Siberian city of Omsk and what it will mean for politics in the region. Can a 28-year-old blogger with a wild afro become the mayor of Russia's seventh largest city? I'd like to remind you that you are listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service. I'd also like to remind you that you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at RFERL.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical.
Why did you make this decision? Are you joking?
No, it's true. Omsk will have a mayor election soon, and I think this is a good chance to try out some of my ideas.
But what if they tell you to get a haircut?
Why?
Well, if they tell you it's unusual for a man to have such extravagant hair.
The people choose, and we'll find voters who are ready for this.
That was the popular Moscow-based blogger Ilya Varlamov, who sports a wild brown afro, being interviewed by Deutsche TV about his decision to run for mayor of Omsk in June. Varlamov has earned a cult following by blogging about how to make Russia's cities more livable, greener, and more friendly to the handicapped. He won a primary last weekend conducted by the local NGO Citizen Mayor to select a unified opposition candidate for mayor, taking 42% of the vote and besting established local politicians like Oleg Kostarev of the local branch of Yabloko and Oleg Smolin, a state Duma deputy from the Communists. Varlamov says he plans to raise money from small donations from ordinary citizens and employ retired military officers for his campaign. Kirill, just a few years ago, nobody would have taken this seriously. But after what we saw happen in Tolyatti and Yaroslavl, where opposition candidates were elected mayor, Varlamov's quixotic campaign in Omsk is attracting a lot of attention. Does he have a chance, or is he a modern version of the 19th century Narodniki, middle-class intelligentsia who went out to live among the common people and were rejected by them? Putting it shortly, should the Kremlin fear the guy with the fro?
Varlamov's campaign is, you're right, on the one hand, it's quixotic.
Yeah.
And this historical analogy that you used about Narodniki and so on is absolutely perfect and correct in some sense, I just, I want to remind our audience about this Narodniki. That was a group of young intellectuals and students in St. Petersburg and Moscow in the middle of 19th century who moved to countryside, to so-called narod, people, ordinary people, plain people of Russia, to enlighten them with the idea of their freedom, with the idea of education, with the idea of modern medicine, and so on. They tried to work as teachers, as doctors, and so on. They were hugely and violently persecuted or oppressed by the authorities. And as you told, I'm absolutely sure, they were rejected. Almost totally rejected by the local population. It was kind of one of the last projects of so-called Enlightenment Age of 18th century, but Russia is a little bit late in this sense. So, and I can find a lot of parallels between these historical events and now all this quixotic campaign of Varlamov and another. A lot of things that happened now in Russia.
Although I would point out one key difference, and that is that Varlamov was invited by locals in Omsk to come and participate in this campaign. He was invited by Citizen Mayor, which was an organization, a grassroots local organization in Omsk that grew out of efforts to monitor elections and decided that they wanted to have this primary, this online primary, to choose a mayoral candidate. And they wanted to get some fresh blood into the process so it wouldn't be just all the same politicians competing. They invited Varlamov to compete. He said no initially. He didn't want to do it. He thought it was a crazy idea. He said, I'm from Moscow. How am I going to be mayor of Omsk? I'm 28 years old. I got a crazy afro. I don't know if he said all these things, but I'm sure they crossed his mind. But at the end of the day, he couldn't resist the invitation. He just the opportunity was too interesting for him to resist. And what do you know, he won the primary, beating some very established local politicians. So it's not this case of some privileged Moscow boy going out to the provinces to teach the locals about democracy. It was the locals who said, please come and participate in our primary, and he did, and he won.
That is my second point. From this point of view, of course, this campaign is not quixotic, but brave.
Just I'd say brave. It's very brave.
Very brave. And I think that all Russian opposition and anyway, all creative class or whatever, all the modern, I don't know, social classes of Russia, they have to support him.
He's the new hero. Yes. Yeah, he's going to be the new hero.
Yeah. It's very interesting that now it's a time for a new heroes in Russian opposition politics.
Yeah, it is. It is. Yes, and a lot of them are emerging.
From Navalny. Alex Shane, he's an old one, but he's...
But his new incarnation is
a new incarnation,
different.
Yes, and Varlamov and a lot of other people, including Ksenia Sobchak,
Ulashov, and Yaroslavl.
Yes, because it's a very... I'm understanding that we're just avoiding the main
topic.
No, it's
all right, but it's relevant.
Yes, but because I'm speaking about new heroes. 2 years ago, all this political scene of Russian opposition was important, but a little bit boring. Mm-hmm. Same people, same figures. From Nemtsov to Ryzhkov, all of them are very respectable politicians and so on, but all the same faces for 10, 12, 15 years.
Yeah.
The drama or tragedy of all of these people is that they entered the politics very early, when they were very, very young. And now they're still around 50, but...
Yeah. They're not as interesting as they used to be. But now we have, it's part and parcel of a new generation coming up.
And secondly, the source of all this regiment of new heroes, it's very interesting. It's different from the social and political source or background of the old generation. Alekshin here, he is a leftist activist and so on, from a nationalist, by the way, activist from the beginning of 1990s. Varlamov is from the
he's 28 years old. Yes. He's 28 years old. The guy was seven when the Soviet Union broke up.
Just from the web. Yeah. From the web, yeah?
Yeah. And by the way, I've kind of did a little research on him. He's a very serious person. He's done a lot. He's done some very serious blogging about things like improving handicapped access for Muscovites.
For me, he's more serious, more serious than Navalny. More serious, because he's not about just the corruption and such things. It's very important, but Varlamov is about the everyday life.
Street level life. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Everyday issues. Yes. And he's out.
He's not populist in this way.
No. His campaign against idiocy, where he would go around photographing things that were just, he felt were stupid and needed to be fixed.
Yeah.
And he's earned a nationwide cult following doing this.
Yes. That's why I consider his figure more seriously than other politician leaders, save Alekshin. I think
Alekshin's taking it to the limits right now.
So now what we're watching, which process we are watching now? It's approaching of appearing of a new generation of political leaders in the position and the extending of the limits of the possible ways of the protests and opposition activity and so on. Both of them are very important, very crucial in this sense. Mm-hmm. Because as we told 20 or 25 minutes ago, Putin and Kremlin is concentrated on this weak majority. Right. And what about this strong minority? This strong minority is expanding.
Yes. That demographically and economically.
Yes. 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 That is the point. That is the point.
So could he win?
No. Absolutely no.
Why
no not? Chance. No chance.
Why
no chance? Because it's Russia, it's Omsk, because it's...
Omsk is... United Russia and the authorities are very, very unpopular in Omsk.
Yes,
I know. The local elite's divided. The election is one round. It's one round. He can win 30% of the vote and become mayor.
I know. But they could mobilize so-called plain people of Omsk to play this card that this
he's
is
a Muscovite.
Muscovite,
he's a carpetbagger,
yes, and so.
Yeah.
But one very important thing, one of his supporters is this Alex Smolin. Mm-hmm. He's a very respectable figure.
Yes.
Absolutely, very respectable. Of course, he's a member of the Communist Party and so on, but he's very prominent specialist in education. He was a former head of educational committee of State Duma. I think he was maybe the best head of the committee in all Dumas in post-Soviet Russia. He's a very serious politician, and he's a very honest man. And he's very influential, not just inside the Communist Party, but in Siberia.
Well, if the Communists can mobilize their electorate for him, that's something.
They are very suspicious. Zyuganov and his supporters, they are very suspicious to Alex Smolin. Mm-hmm. And that is, I think, in future he will... I think he will leave the Communist Party for some other...
Social democratic structure
maybe,
or something.
Maybe.
I mean, something to watch also is the way this primary was conducted. Every candidate that participated in the primary was supposed to pledge to support the winner. Now let's see if they're going to do it, which would mean he would have the support of the Communist candidate, Yablokas candidate, Just Russia's candidate. I mean, there's a lot of kind of organizational muscle that can be used on the ground there. So I'm... you know, you play the pessimist and I play the optimist, like always. But I still think it's a long shot. But I think I would not exclude the possibility that this 28-year-old dude with a wild afro could end up being mayor of Russia's seventh largest city. But even if he loses,
I think the difference between us that I am Strategically, I'm an optimist. Uh-huh. And tactically,
I'm a pessimist.
And you vice versa.
I'm the opposite, I guess. Well, but I would also say, sticking with the optimistic theme, that even if he loses, the fact of his campaign, the fact that this primary happened, the fact that those who participate in the primary are supporting the winner, this is a good precedent for the opposition. This could be replicated. I'd like to see this replicated at the national level. Mm-hmm. But also the way he's going to conduct his campaign. He says he's going to rely on small donations. Let's see if he does it. If he gets small donations from people in Omsk to contribute to his campaign, and the whole idea is I'm going to be your mayor, well, you do your campaigning and your fundraising at the same time. It's a very interesting model. It's been tried in the West. It's been used routinely in the United States.
But you are watched closely by FSB, and so
of course you are. Yeah. Of course you are. But this is an interesting precedent. He says he's going to hire retired military officers to work as his campaign
staff.
That's very interesting and very clever. So even if he loses, he could win by losing.
Sure, it will be a kind of matrix for future events, such events in the other mayor's elections and maybe in the next presidential elections. That's why I'm speaking that I'm pessimist. In the
short term, but an optimist
in the long term. But after the 6 years, next 6 years, maybe shorter period of Russian history, then all this mechanism, they could work.
Well, this just goes back to what I said right after the Duma elections back in December in Russia. Everything is changing and nothing is changing and everything is changing and nothing is changing.
At the same time, yeah.
At the same
time.
On
various levels,
yeah. Yeah. Or the winds of change are sweeping very slowly is another way to put it. Unfortunately, as always, I'd like to continue this discussion all evening, but that's all that we have time for today. I'd like to remind you that you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me has been my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin, managing editor of RFERL's Russian service. I'd also like to remind you that you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noize MC.